From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As U.S. President Barack Obama plans a meeting with the monarchs of the Persian Gulf Arab states, some problems have come to the surface. Press TV's Colin Campbell reports from Washington, D.C.
As the White House prepares for an unprecedented summit with leaders of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council at Camp David this week, it has already received a bit of discouraging news. The six member nations of the GCC are Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman. But King Salman of Saudi Arabia, a key ally of the United States, will not attend the summit. The Sultan of Oman and the President of the UAE are staying away as well, citing health concerns.
The goal of the meeting that the president has planned for Camp David later this week is to discuss the best ways to deepen and modernize the important security relationship between the United States and our GCC partners.
The White House insists that King Salman's absence is a result of scheduling issues.
The reason for the change in the king's travel schedule is not related at all to the substance of the meeting. I think what they have indicated is that he has said that he'd prefer to remain in Saudi Arabia to monitor the implementation of the humanitarian pause in Yemen.
President Obama's challenge will be to win over Persian Gulf Arab leaders that America's negotiations with Iran over its nuclear energy program, which it insists is for peaceful purposes only, are beneficial for the region over the long term. But in Washington, any topic can be politicized.
Since the beginning of the Bush administration, or at least midway in the Bush administration, has been arguing the case that Iran is striving to get nuclear weapons, and the fact is that there's no evidence to support that.
Talks between the U.S. and Iran are in their final stages. They're heading towards a deal that could curb Iran's nuclear activities in exchange for lifting sanctions. President Obama planned to meet with the Saudi king ahead of this week's summit, but instead will meet with the Interior Minister, Mohammed bin Nayef. Colin Campbell, Press TV, Washington.
An Iranian cargo ship carrying humanitarian aid left the country's port city of Bandar Abbas for Yemen Monday and was due to arrive in the war-torn country in the next 10 days. Press TV's Mehdi Jamshidi has more.
The world has witnessed nearly 50 days of deadly Saudi airstrikes on the impoverished country of Yemen. Along with the continuous airstrikes and bombardment of civilians, Saudi planes and naval ships have imposed a blockade on Yemeni airports and seaports. Despite the blockade, a cargo prepared by Iranian NGOs as well as Iran's Red Crescent is setting sail to the war-torn country.
Iran is sending 2,500 tons of humanitarian aid with this ship. The aid is being sent in association with International Red Cross and Red Crescent. The ship departed from the Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas and is now on the Sea of Oman heading southeast toward the Yemeni port of Hodeidah.
This is not the first time Iran is trying to deliver humanitarian aid to Yemen. Last month, Saudi Arabia prevented two Iranian civilian planes from delivering medical aid and food supplies to the impoverished country.
Iran's aid convoy was supposed to be sent to Yemen by airplanes, but Saudi Arabia did not allow Iranian planes to land. Officials in Yemen and even Saudi Arabia have been informed about Iran's aid ship. Hopefully, there will be no problem in unloading the ship in its destination.
In addition to the journalists and the crew, a band of international anti-war activists and a group of volunteer doctors are on board.
I'm here on board of this ship, Iran Shahid, to make sure that the world gets to know, help that the world gets to know, about the atrocities of the U.S.-backed Saudis in Yemen against the civilian population, against any law. It's a multi-criminal, brutal massacring of civilian people.
The journey will take 7 to 10 days, and if the ship is allowed to dock in the destination port, the cargo will be delivered to Yemeni officials, Red Crescent, and Red Cross representatives. Reporting for Press TV, Mehdi Jamshidi, Sea of Oman.
Final preparations were underway Tuesday for large aid deliveries into Yemen by UN agencies as they waited to see if last week's proposed cessation of Saudi air attacks would materialize. According to the UN, tens of thousands of people across Yemen desperately need help. Daniel Johnson has more.
If the ceasefire comes into effect, agencies including UNHCR World Food Programme and World Health Organization plan to launch a massive aid operation. UN Refugee Agency's Adrian Edwards said it was vital that the pause in hostilities happens since supplies are dwindling.
We're urging all parties to observe the ceasefire in full, to respect international humanitarian law and cease any targeting of civilians or civilian infrastructure, and to allow the urgent delivery of aid to tens of thousands of vulnerable Yemenis and refugees who desperately need some respite.
An estimated 300,000 people have been made homeless by the conflict since it escalated in late March, and that's on top of the 330,000 people already displaced in Yemen, according to UNHCR. It plans to airlift 300 tons of blankets, kitchen kits and plastic sheeting and assess needs in areas that have been difficult to reach because of the conflict. World Health Organization said the ceasefire will allow it to bring in 30 tons of supplies and for the first time to move 11 tons of medical supplies already in the country to field locations where they're needed. WHO's Tarek Jazarevich said that power cuts and fuel shortages had forced hospitals to close key units.
Some of them have started to shut down some of their departments, especially operation rooms and intensive care units, in order to reduce consumption of fuel. There is obviously the issue of security for health workers and also a problem for them to get to work because of the fuel shortages, as they cannot find the transport.
World Food Programme, meanwhile, said it was ready to provide food to more than 750,000 people in conflicted areas, as well as special food products to 25,000 children. But it'll cost $43 million per month for the next 3 months, WFP spokesperson Elizabeth Beers said. Since the conflict escalated in late March, more than 1,400 people have died, according to latest UN figures. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
Tensions are growing among Eurozone finance ministers over the Greek debt crisis and the possibility that Athens might default on its loans from international creditors. The ministers failed to reach a new bailout agreement with Greece during a Tuesday meeting in Brussels. Press TV's Jerome Hughes was in Brussels for that meeting and filed this report.
The tension between Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis and Eurogroup President Jeroen Dijsselbloem was clear to see at this meeting of Eurozone finance ministers in Brussels. Varoufakis says Greece has just made a loan repayment of €750 million to the International Monetary Fund, but he is unable to say how public salaries and pension payments, due at the end of this month, will be made by the Greek government. The EU and IMF want Greece to implement austerity measures in return for a €7.2 billion bailout. But so far, the sides haven't been able to find an agreement. Varoufakis has raised tensions by talking about Greece holding a referendum to ratify any deal reached in Brussels. If the deal was rejected in a referendum, then Greece would default on its debts and exit the Eurozone.
A referendum is always an option for any government in Greece. It's part of our constitution. It's up to the Prime Minister to decide whether he wants to recommend one.
Germany's Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble is continuing to take a tough stance against Greece and has even said that a referendum might be a good idea.
Analysts say that the Syriza-led government in Greece finds itself in an almost impossible position. If it breaks anti-austerity election pledges, it will lead to angry protests on the streets and a rebellion within the Syriza party itself. At the same time, compromising on its anti-austerity policies is the only way that it can unlock desperately needed bailout funds.
The Eurozone finance ministers have released a statement saying that progress has been made, but experts say there is still a long way to go.
We're very far from an actual deal because the hot issues, the key issues, the issues that there is a lot of difference in, like reforms in the pension system, in the labour system, fiscal situation of Greece, have not been tackled yet.
Yanis Varoufakis has admitted that government cash flow in Greece will become a critical issue in the next couple of weeks, and so reaching a bailout deal as soon as possible is essential. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in the Russian city of Sochi on Tuesday for high-level talks with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and President Vladimir Putin over a number of current issues of international concern, including the situation in Ukraine. Kerry's visit to Sochi Tuesday was the first visit to Russia by a senior American official since the start of the upheaval in Ukraine in 2014 and the resulting deterioration in relations between Moscow and Washington. Russia's foreign minister reportedly told his U.S. counterpart that his country will not bow to any pressure or betray its own interests, and that the only way for Washington to deal with Moscow is as an equal partner. The officials discussed the situation in Ukraine, and both sides, according to a statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry, acknowledged that the only solution to the Ukrainian crisis was a political one. The two also discussed the Islamic State terrorist group, which has used the past 4 years of war in Syria to gain territory and influence. Lavrov reportedly stressed the need to, quote, abandon double standards concerning terrorists, closed quote, according to the Russian Foreign Ministry. This past weekend saw a massive but solemn commemoration in Russia of the 70th anniversary of the surrender of Nazi Germany's military to the Red Army of the Soviet Union in Berlin. Although the event was boycotted by President Obama and a number of U.S. allies, most of the rest of the world's powers were well represented at the event. Peter Laval, the host of RT's Crosstalk, was there as well, and he spoke with us via Skype Tuesday about the weekend's activities and a lot more.
You know, Don, it's a real pity because I am so proud and feel very privileged to have been in Moscow during the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, the victory over fascism in Europe. I have never been more moved in my life. For all the nonsense that people write and say about Russia, I was genuinely moved. The whole country was moved. Russians are not particularly friendly to each other. Let me tell you that, okay? It's a pretty tough place. It's an elbow place, okay? But on Victory Day, May 9th, everything was transformed. The parade itself was very beautiful. It reminded the world that Russia is not an aggressor, but it will defend itself at all costs. And considering what's going on in the world, that's not a bad idea. Then there was the Regiment of the Immortals, and this was the most amazing thing. I know many people participated in it. Citizens of all walks of life would have a picture of their grandfather or father or great-grandfather that was killed in the Great War, the Great Patriotic War, as it's called here, and they marched to the streets of Moscow. In the West, they always talk about a million-man march. Well, this has millions really? Of people marching, millions, wow. All across Russia. Vladimir Putin led in Moscow for a short while. Of course, his security was there, but it wasn't obvious. But here's a man that was walking with the people, with his people, and he has their support. So, Don, I can't give enough superlatives. It was extremely moving. History is alive here, and it's a reminder to all Russians that what they had to pay for to defeat fascism and all these kind of rabid ideologies, anti-Semitism during the 1930s and 40s, is that they remember, unfortunately, in countries like Ukraine, that historical memory is being wiped clean completely.
Yeah, when you talk about costs, Russia lost more than 27 million, maybe 30 million people in that period, in that war, which is more than all of the rest of the countries in Europe combined, including Germany.
It's really quite amazing is that more Russians died, civilians died, during the siege of Leningrad than American soldiers that died during the entire war. Now, that's not to diminish the loss of American lives, not at all, but the magnitude is very rarely put into perspective of what happened. One in 14 Soviet citizens died during that war. That is a horrific, horrific loss.
Five times as many Soviet citizens were killed by the Germans as Jews also, which, you know, is remarkable to me. It would be hard to imagine a memorial over the Holocaust, for example, without a U.S. president showing up, and yet President Obama snubbed this commemoration.
Well, the empty suit of the United States of America doesn't surprise me. I find his foreign policy decisions to be abominable and really shameful for America. America is leading from behind in the worst possible way, in the sense of being moral and right. My goodness, are we so cut from our roots? It's amazing. But, you know, as a good friend of mine, Dmitry Babich, he's a political analyst here in Moscow, a good friend of mine, and we were on my Crosstalk program, we talked about the boycott, and he said, you know, Peter, it's good that these people didn't come to tarnish and to soil this great moment in the memory of the Russian nation and other nations that fought under the Soviet flag. And I thought, you know, he convinced me on my own program that he had a point. Why do we want people here that want to deny what Russians and other people of the Soviet Union paid in the most horrific way. If they don't want to recognize historical memory, then they don't belong here at all. And why the West actually just didn't report, they didn't report very much about what happened in Moscow, and they actually didn't report too much what happened in Kiev, because what happened in Kiev was a monstrosity. I mean, you can't use any Soviet symbols, you can't use the Red Star, you can't use anything. What the hell was that all about? Was it a parade for what? I mean, there are no symbols whatsoever from the Soviet era. It's illegal in Ukraine right now to do that. Can you believe that? And what about the millions of Ukrainians that actually gave their lives to end fascism in Europe? They've been silenced. The silence and the chilling effect is horrific. You know, before all this happened in Ukraine, the European Union was willing to sanction Yanukovych because of one political prisoner, Yulia Tymoshenko. There are tens of thousands of political prisoners now in Ukraine. And does the West say a word?
Yeah. I mean, it was bizarre last week. Ban Ki-moon was in Kiev with Poroshenko, who was surrounded, of course, by these security services, which are dominated by the people who openly worship Stepan Bandera, who was a Nazi collaborator, and congratulating Poroshenko for his country's role, and not even his country's role, but saying, you know, this is where the Nazis were stopped, and congratulations.
Goodness, you know, and it's just, you know, Don, you know, one of the things I did in preparation for my programs on Victory Day is I watched the World at War series, the BBC series, the 1973 series.
Sure.
26 parts. Brilliant. One of the best documentaries ever made.
Yes.
And, you know, if you think about the history of the Cold War, we can put it from 1945 or 1947, whatever you want, 47 to 1991. 73 is kind of right in the middle, kind of right smack in the middle of the Cold War. And if you watch the World at War documentary series, how remarkably fair they are to the Soviet Union. One of my favorite historians, Jeffrey Roberts, a writer on Soviet history, before we started the recording of Crosstalk, we were talking about it, and we both admitted that every time I watch the specific episodes on the Soviet Union, tears fall from my eye because of just how horrific that war was. When Hitler said he wanted a war of annihilation, he wasn't joking. And Stalin, when he said, you want a war of annihilation, well, we will give you one. And he wasn't kidding either.
That's right. He annihilated the Nazis in Germany, for sure. Because most of what goes on in Kiev right now is still, even if not in spirit, but legally, is illegal in Berlin. So Stalin did a pretty good job of that.
You know, it's really sad for me because Angela Merkel came to on the day after, on the 10th of May.
Right.
And I find that so demeaning. I mean, particularly from a German leader. It's not been that long. We're not talking about the French Revolution or Napoleon's exile or whatever, okay? And we're not talking about the Roman Empire. We're talking about something where people still have a memory of. There are still veterans, people that remember that war. And have her, a German leader, come and snub the Russian leader, I find quite appalling. And you know what, Don, it is another piece of evidence. I've been on your program many times here. Is it's a lack of leadership and a lack of a moral leadership in the West. You know, no matter how Russia and Germany and the European Union and the United States get along at this point in time, we should all always come together to commemorate the ending of that horrific regime that ruled Europe and could have succeeded if it hadn't been for the Soviet sacrifice. And let's keep this in mind. When Americans like to think of Saving Private Ryan, well, there were like 10 divisions in north of France. There were count scores and scores of divisions in the East, and they were the best. They were the most experienced. They had the best equipment. It was all in the East, and we still have this Saving Private Ryan syndrome. It's a great film. Great film. Don't get me wrong. But it doesn't tell the history of the war of the people, of the majority of the people that experienced it.
That's absolutely right. Today, history, you're an historian. Today is, has it like a double whammy anniversary. It's 97 years ago that Germany, towards the end of World War I, that Germany and Austro-Hungary set up a quote-unquote free and independent Ukraine, in Kiev. That was in 1918 on today's date. And then on this date in 1989, George H.W. Bush, then president, essentially laid out the schedule for the end of the Cold War that was imminent. He had been, talked about we're going to re-engineer our relationship with the Soviet Union and get the most favored nation trading status and all this other stuff. It's kind of interesting that those two anniversaries are happening.
Yeah, there was the Chicken Kiev speech. Yeah,
that's right.
It was really interesting. But, you know, it's really interesting as if we, again, from a historical point of view, the father of modern Ukraine is Joseph Stalin, all right?
That's right.
I mean, and maybe the great uncles are Lenin and Khrushchev, but it was Stalin that essentially determined those borders. And no one wants to admit that. I mean, I look at like at South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and I always like to point out that it was Mikhail Saakashvili. He's the godfather of their independence, okay?
Yeah.
Of course, Georgians don't like to hear that. But see, this is just the thing here, that history is so often forgotten. For example, I was observing it in Western media. I call it the echo chamber living here in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And with Stalin made a pact with Hitler. Well, any historian of worth his salt or her salt, and I'm not talking about Timothy Snyder, who was a disgrace to American historians,
right.
With his palling around with fascists in Ukraine. It's just appalling. But, you know, everybody dealt with Hitler in the 1930s, okay? Mm-hmm. Everybody did, including Stalin. And you know what? If you can just take off the ideological blinders, I was anti-communist and I was anti-Soviet, and I don't make any qualms about that. But I live in a different country, in a different time. But Stalin acted rationally. He acted rationally. The Brits and the French wouldn't come to an agreement with him for the Soviet Union's own protection and defense, so he had to make a deal with Hitler. It was forced upon him. So, you know, people that don't know history go around and make all these very, very simplistic claims. And that's not a defense of Joseph Stalin. That's a defense of the sovereign borders of the Soviet Union.
That's right, which ended up being very prescient because as Hitler attacked, he had to start in the middle of Poland instead of at the Soviet borders, and it helped
right.
a lot.
Well, no, the thing is that from the if you look at the Soviet leadership's worldview at that time, they watched the Western powers, Britain, France, and Italy, carve up Czechoslovakia. It wasn't Hitler that carved up Czechoslovakia in 1938. It was the Western powers that carved it up and gave it to Hitler. Remember that history. If I were sitting in Moscow and say, oh, these are our new partners on the horizon to protect ourselves from this savage, this barbarian Hitler, I mean, the Soviet leadership drew the exact right conclusion. And, you know, it was the Western powers that guaranteed the sovereignty of all those new countries in Eastern Europe after Versailles. Again, where are the historians out there to tell us the truth? It's, you know, history is full of terrible things, yes, but that's why we study history and try to learn from it, not whitewash it for immediate political expediency.
And if you're doing anything but the latter, generally you end up with the same history instead of revising it every few years out of convenience. You know,
it's extremely dangerous to do that. And you know, and what it is that it makes people like Vladimir Putin extremely suspicious in dealing with Western powers because they lie and they lie and they lie. They break the rules and they think they're above the law.
You know, one of the nexus points of that is. Something you mentioned with respect to Czechoslovakia, because the myth here is that Neville Chamberlain essentially capitulated and, you know, to Hitler and, you know, was an act of appeasement, the carving up of Czechoslovakia. But in fact, it was something a lot more sinister, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, when you look at Chamberlain, and if you look at the historical record, when Hitler came to power in 1933 when he was appointed chancellor. He wasn't elected. He was appointed.
Right.
And the British knew what this guy was up to. I mean, they had a pretty good idea that they're going to scrap the Versailles Agreement because it was fundamentally unfair, and it was fundamentally created disadvantages for European security. And so what he was told, and it was quite rational, and I'm a lot easier on Turkey than on Chamberlain than most people are, you know, he said we can't afford to fight a war. We don't have the resources. We need almost a decade to be prepared. It's very interesting. Stalin said something very similar about the same time. And so Britain had to buy time. They had to buy time, and there wasn't anything they could militarily do anyway when it came to Eastern Europe. They weren't prepared to defend Eastern Europe. Now, where the mistakes were made was the Saar Basin and the Ruhrland, okay? That's where mistakes were made. If they had moved one division, one regiment in, Hitler's forces would have returned. And Hitler thought he'd be a great strategist because he could bluff. And he bluffed on two areas of Western Germany that nobody really cared much about anymore in the West. And so, you know, I look at Chamberlain as a very tragic figure because militarily there wasn't much he could do to save Eastern Europe because the agreement made at the end of the Second World War, the Versailles Treaty, was fundamentally flawed. It could not protect these countries, and these countries all committed gross violations against their minorities, including the country of Poland. And Czechoslovakia had a lot of issues as well. So this was the flaw. For me, it is the double whammy, the double mistake of putting the sanctity of borders and self-determination in the same bottle or the same toxic drink, because one has to work over the other. You can't have them simultaneously equal. It does not compute.
That's actually a lesson that can be applied to the situation in Ukraine today, isn't it?
Absolutely. The sad thing is, what so many people don't understand is that if you look at the Donbass, you know, look at Donetsk, that area, and the identity issue that they had before this crisis is that they could muddle through. They spoke Russian, but they had Russian. They had Ukrainian passports. There was no problem going to Russia with that passport. They could live in parallel identities because nobody forced them to choose. But when the coup happened and you have neo-Nazis coming to positions of great power in Kiev, then they had to choose. They had to choose, and they obviously chose their Russian identity, their Russian religion, and their Russian narrative of history. It was forced upon them, and that is the reason why Vladimir Putin has not and will not ever invade Eastern Ukraine, because there's too many Ukrainians there that say, I'm Ukrainian, I speak Ukrainian, I'm Catholic or another religion, and they like Bandera, okay? And they would be, technically, if Putin decided to move Russia's army there, they would be occupiers. And that's why he will never, ever make a military move for the East. And policymakers, smart people know that in the West, but they won't say it.
It's eerie, looking at the almost constant irritation, tension that the United States seems to prefer to induce in different countries. And, you know, in the Middle East, it's one thing, but they're doing it on the border of Russia.
Well, it's so wrongheaded in the sense that we started out our chat here about the festivities and the commemoration of Victory Day 70 years on. And, you know, I thank Victoria Nuland for this. Okay, thank you, Victoria Nuland, because you've united Russia like I have never seen it in the 18 years that I've lived here. People are proud of their country, and they're not going to bow down to us. There are people that I've known for the entire time here, and they're good folks, they're neighbors, they're not politically driven, they don't talk about politics, but when the issue of Ukraine is mentioned, the seething anger the average Russian has against the United States for what they have done to Ukraine. And that's going to be, that will probably never be repaired. I just can't see it. Because these people, they're the relatives in the East. I have working with people moving clothes and shoes, all anything that these people need. And people, I'm not even worried about being stolen because everyone is so spot on. We got to help our brethren across the border. Because these militias that are being, and these are not government units, these are private militias that have the most odious ideology, and the Americans are training them. They started training, not the Ukrainian military. Let's be clear, not the Ukrainian military, Ukraine's militias. That's who they're training. This is another huge stain on American foreign policy. We should not be doing that. We should not be helping these people.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.